Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the February 8th, Tuesday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Nadler. Today we will be reading the following main articles: Audit of Colorado's Judicial Branch, Evidence of Illegal Actions. Four former employees have been referred for criminal investigation by Shelley Bradbury. Douglas County Schools, students walk out in protest. Demonstration in reaction to superintendent's firing by Jessica Seaman. Ukraine, Biden, pipeline to be blocked if Russia invades by Amir Madhani, Sylvie Corbett, and Vladimir Izetchenkov. Merger would create fifth largest airline. Frontier makes $3 billion bid for Spirit Airlines by Megan Ululani Boyanton. Audit of Colorado's Judicial Branch. Evidence of illegal actions. Four former employees have been referred for criminal investigation by Shelley Bradbury, The Denver Post. An investigation by the state auditor into the Colorado Judicial Branch found evidence of occupational fraud, apparently illegal transactions, and the misuse of public funds, according to an executive summary made public Monday. The Office of the State Auditor, or OSA, will report four former employees of the State Court Administrator's Office to law enforcement for additional criminal investigation. The auditor's office reported finding evidence that former Chief of Staff Mindy Mayasis and former Human Resources Director Eric Brown collected speaking and consulting fees while on state time, gave an unusually large separation settlement to an employee with access to damaging information against them, and attempted to ensure Mayasis would be granted a $2.75 million contract as she left her job. Conduct by Mayasis Brown, former State Court Administrator Chris Ryan, and an unnamed employee all warrant reports to law enforcement for further investigation, the summary says. Ryan did not immediately return a request for comment Monday, and Mayasis and Brown could not be reached. A spokesman for the State Judicial Department declined to comment on the summary of the audit's findings. The Denver Post last year reported allegations by Ryan that Mayasis was given the $2.75 million contract to keep her from speaking out about judicial misconduct after she left her job in March 2019. The state auditor's office did not find direct evidence of such a quid pro quo arrangement, but did find evidence that Mayasis sought out the contract before she resigned and that Brown and Mayasis attempted to influence the contracting process to ensure Mayasis was awarded the contract, the executive summary says. The OSA found some evidence that Ms. Mayasis requested the promise of a contract before resigning, the summary reads. However, the OSA did not obtain evidence that Ms. Mayasis was promised a contract for such services prior to her signing a resignation agreement. The summary goes on to outline a series of problems with the way the contract was awarded to Mayasis. Evidence suggests Brown included specific experience requirements in the contract that were designed to ensure only Mayasis would qualify, the summary says. 24 prospective bidders viewed the contract, which was to provide leadership training over a five-year span for a maximum of $550,000 per year. None applied for the contract, however, and it was then awarded to Mayasis 20 days after her resignation. The auditor's investigation also looked at an unusually large settlement agreement given to an employee who was under investigation in 2018 for the inappropriate use of information obtained through their position, the summary says. The unnamed employee had access to information that could have been used against Mayasis and Brown. the auditor's office found, and was given 15 months of paid administrative leave and severance that was worth a combined $143,000. That was the largest settlement agreement paid by the judicial branch in the 17 years prior, the summary says. The settlement was handled by Mansus and Brown and was approved by Ryan, who is a personal friend of the employee. All three ignored the advice of a staff attorney who said that a lower settlement was appropriate. Mr. Brown and Ms. Mansus handled certain aspects of the employee's disciplinary investigation and settlement themselves, and without always involving legal counsel, even though they had actual or potential conflicts of interest, since they were targets of the employee's alleged misconduct, the report states. The auditor's investigation also discovered that both Mansus and Brown did work for the National Center for State Courts while on the clock with the state in 2018 and 2019. Mansus earned $17,200 and Brown earned $26,800 in their state salaries for hours when they were doing outside work, according to the summary. The state auditor's office is required to report evidence of illegal transactions and the misuse or embezzlement of public funds or property to law enforcement. The summary does not name a specific agency that will receive the criminal referrals, and Greg Fugate, a spokesman for the Office of the State Auditor, declined Monday to say which law enforcement agency will be involved, citing confidentiality rules. The auditor's investigation began in May 2019, after the agency received an anonymous tip. Investigators reviewed 16,000 documents and interviewed 11 current and former Judicial Department employees as they investigated. The state auditor's investigation did not find any evidence of fraud around the use of family medical leave and did not find evidence to support allegations that former financial services director David Cribbs' departure from the state court administrator's office was problematic or linked to Messias's departure. In a letter to Judicial Department employees Monday, Colorado Supreme Court Justice Brian Boatwright emphasized that no current employees would be referred to law enforcement and that referrals do not mean laws were broken or that criminal charges will be filed. The OSA's investigation and report are helpful in continuing to improve the department's policies regarding leave and contracting, and the department has, since 2019, implemented several changes to the personnel and fiscal rules to improve operations. We continue to look for ways to improve further, he wrote. Boatwright has in the past pledged to make public the results of investigations into the $2.75 million contract and alleged judicial misconduct, but is not expected to release the full audit report, which is confidential under state law. We are working to provide the full investigation report to the investigators for other pending investigations, Boatwright wrote in the letter to employees, adding that he could not comment further because of the ongoing investigations. The auditor's investigation is one of at least six launched into the circumstances around the Messias contract. The FBI, Attorney Regulation Council, Colorado Commission on Judicial Discipline, and two independent law firms are all carrying out their own investigations. The auditor's report notes that the judicial branch was concerned about protecting attorney-client privilege during the auditor's investigation, and so were granted multiple opportunities to review the report and executive summary and redact information they identified as privileged attorney work product or subject to other legal protections. Douglas County Schools. Students walk out in protest. Demonstration in reaction to superintendent's firing. By Jessica Seaman, The Denver Post. Hundreds of students streamed out of at least eight Douglas County School District schools Monday in protest of the school board's Friday firing of the district superintendent. The students left their school buildings at 1:10 p.m. in a coordinated action at schools including Highlands Ranch High School, Crest Hill Middle School, Ponderosa High School, and Rock Canyon High School. The protests largely focused on supporting former Superintendent Corey Wise, but students also expressed their concerns with the school board's recent vote to change the district's equity policy. The core four school board members wanted to be all about the parents and what the parents want, but they aren't the ones in school, said 17-year-old Audrey Yakubovich, who is a junior at Highlands Ranch High School and whose mother teaches in the district. I've seen what Corey has done for these teachers, she added. He stood up for the teachers. Monday's walkout is the second demonstration to take place in a matter of days over the leadership of Douglas County School District. Hundreds of teachers called out sick Thursday, forcing the district to cancel classes, and rallied to support Wise and demand transparency from the school board. National debates over COVID-19 and race have been playing out in Douglas County school board meetings since before the four new conservative members were elected in November. Since the new members' arrival, the board has been split on issues such as lifting mask requirements for schools and changing the district's equity policy, and that division was never more apparent than it was last week. The board fired Wise without cause on Friday during a contentious meeting that was as much about the deep mistrust among members as it was about his future with the district. Board President Mike Peterson said during the meeting that he was worried about having a person selected by the three minority members leading the district. This is not retaliation at all, he said during the meeting. This is my ability to trust that we're not going to get sucker punched by the other three folks that are going to come in when we are trying to work through an issue. Wise worked in the district for almost three decades, including as a teacher, and was in his first year as superintendent. He previously served as interim superintendent before he was chosen for the role in April. The school district has to pay Wise his annual salary, $247,500, plus any unpaid benefits and expenses that he had accrued at the time he was fired, according to his contract. Last week's school board meeting was called after the three minority members held a public Zoom call in which they alleged that Peterson and Christy Williams, the board's vice president, privately told Wise to resign or be voted out. The members, Elizabeth Hansen, Susan Meek, and David Ray, revealed that they learned on January 28th about the ultimatum given to Wise. There had been no vote, meeting, or notice given in advance of the meeting held with Wise, which they said violated Colorado's open meeting laws. The board drew a rebuke from more than 50 current and former Colorado school board members over the weekend, who signed a letter in support of Wise and called his termination a failure of governance. We echo the call by those in the minority on the Douglas County School Board for a transparent process that is in full compliance with the law as they select the next leader for Douglas County Schools, states the February 5th letter. We also hope that the new majority recognizes the need for unity, as they will be charged with bringing together a divided community. A warning of what was to come. The allegations that the school board majority's members were planning to oust Wise added further fuel to teachers and staff members already upset at the board for directing the superintendent to recommend changes to the equity policy, prompting about 1,000 people to protest outside the district offices in Castle Rock last week. The previous school board passed the equity policy in March 2021, directing the district to fix inequitable practices and create an equity advisory committee. The policy drew critiques from people who thought it would lead Douglas County schools to teach critical race theory, which examines how racism influences public policy and institutions, such as healthcare. At Monday's walkout, students felt Wise supported the district's equity policy, and now they fear that without him, the district will disband the Equity Advisory Committee, said Mia Warren, 18, who served on the student board that helped select the former superintendent to lead the district. All their voices went into the trash, the Highlands Ranch High senior said. We wanted somebody who did believe in equity. It's just really sad to see it go away so fast. During the protests at Highlands Ranch High, students chanted Equity for All and carried signs that read, Love is love. DCSD supports equality. Keep it that way. a lawsuit over open meeting laws. A Highlands Ranch resident named Robert Marshall, who has children attending Douglas County schools, filed a lawsuit Friday against the four majority members over the allegations they violated open meeting laws. If at least three, or fewer if it means a quorum, school board members meet to discuss public business, then the public and other board members must be notified and the meeting made public, no matter if it occurs in person or via phone, email, or text, per state law. It's not entirely clear if such laws were violated. Douglas County school board members debated during Friday's meeting on the conversation members initially had with Wise, including whether an ultimatum was given. There are no fines or penalties for violating open meeting laws. However, a judge could invalidate a meeting and any action taken during it, said Jeff Roberts, executive director of Colorado Freedom of Information Coalition. The two factions of the board responded differently to the student walkout Monday. I recognize this is an emotional time for our community, and I want you to know I am committed to restoring peace and unity to our school district with a continued focus on educating our children, Peterson said in a statement. Ray said he has suggested the district send its crisis teams to schools to ensure that the mental health needs of our students and staff are being met. Ultimately, I trust our teachers and leaders to help our students through these most challenging times in our district, he said. Ukraine. Biden. Pipeline to be blocked if Russia invades. By Amir Madhani, Sylvie Corbett, and Vladimir Azeshkinov. The Associated Press, Byline, Washington. In a flurry of diplomacy across two continents, President Joe Biden met with Germany's new leader Monday and vowed the crucial Nord Stream 2, Russia-to-Germany gas pipeline, will be blocked if Russia further invades Ukraine. Russia's Vladimir Putin retorted that the U.S. and its allies are the only ones talking invasion. Putin and French President Emmanuel Macron met for more than 5 hours in Moscow. At the same time, Biden and German Chancellor Olaf Scholz spoke at the White House in efforts to defuse the crisis before armed conflict breaks out. Russia has massed thousands of troops at the Ukraine border, adding military might almost daily. The White House has expressed increasing alarm about the prospects of war, and Biden has been looking to solidify support among European allies for economy-jarring sanctions against Russia if it attacks. If Russia invades, that means tanks and troops crossing the border of Ukraine again. Then there will be no longer a Nord Stream 2, Biden said. We will bring an end to it. That would hurt Russia economically, but also cause supply problems for Germany. Construction of the pipeline has been completed, but it is not yet operating. We are jointly ready, and all of NATO is ready, Biden said, referring to the powerful Western alliance, though Ukraine is not a member. While Biden reiterated with certitude that the pipeline would not move forward, Scholz stressed the need to keep some ambiguity about sanctions in order to press Russia to de-escalate the crisis. It's necessary for Russia to understand that a lot more could happen than they've perhaps calculated with themselves, Scholz said. The buildup of more than 100,000 Russian troops near Ukraine has fueled Western worries of a possible offensive. White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan warned Sunday that Russia could invade Ukraine any day, triggering a conflict that would come at an enormous human cost. At the same time, Biden and NATO allies have made clear there are no plans for sending in troops to fight Russia on Ukraine's behalf. Macron and Putin, during their lengthy meeting, with a dinner that featured the choice of sturgeon or reindeer with sweet potatoes and pear pie with vanilla ice cream, registered their disagreements but also emphasized a need for more talks. Putin noted that the U.S. and NATO have ignored Moscow's demands that the alliance guarantee it will keep Ukraine and other ex-Soviet nations out, that they refrain from placing weapons in Ukraine, and roll back alliance forces from Eastern Europe. He, too, signaled his readiness to continue negotiations and denied anew that Russia has any intention of invading Ukraine, We are categorically against any further NATO's expansion eastward because it poses a threat to us, Putin said. It's not us who's advancing to NATO. It's NATO coming to us. And so it's illogical to talk about Russia's aggressive behavior. He scoffed at Western descriptions of NATO as a defensive alliance, saying sarcastically that people of Iraq, Libya, and Afghanistan have learned it from their own experience. And he threatened a wider war if Ukraine should join the alliance and perhaps try to win back Crimea, which Russia annexed in 2014. European countries will automatically be drawn into a military conflict with Russia, Putin said. You'll be drawn into that conflict beyond your will. There will be no winners. Macron described the talks as substantial, deep, with a focus on conditions that could help de-escalation. We tried to build converging elements, he said. The upcoming days will be crucial and deep discussions together will be needed. In the meantime, Biden warned, it would be wise for Americans other than essential diplomats to leave Ukraine. On a positive note, Putin said without elaboration that some of Macron's proposals could serve as a basis for a settlement of the conflict in eastern Ukraine, adding that they agreed to have a call after Macron's visit to Kyiv Tuesday. Likewise, Biden said when asked if there remained an off-ramp for Russia in the standoff, the answer is yes. Before meeting Biden, Scholz told German media that there will be a very high price if Ukraine is attacked militarily, and we are preparing for this very precisely and have been talking about the details for a long time. Scholz is scheduled to travel to Kyiv and Moscow on February 14th to 15th. Separately, German Defense Minister Christine Lambrecht said her country would add up to 350 troops within a few days to about 500 already a part of a NATO battle group in Lithuania. With this, we are strengthening our contribution to forces on NATO's eastern flank and sending a very clear signal of our unity to our allies, she said. Biden already has deployed additional U.S. troops to Poland, Romania, and Germany, and a few dozen elite U.S. troops and equipment landed Sunday in southeastern Poland near the border with Ukraine, with hundreds more infantry troops of the 82nd Airborne Division set to arrive. Britain said the U.S. was sending 350 troops to Poland to bolster NATO forces, joining 100 Royal Engineers already there. At a news conference in Washington, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell defended the increasingly dire Western warnings that a Russian invasion may be imminent. This is not alarmism. This is simply the facts, Blinken said. And the facts are that we've seen over the last few months a massive amassing of Russian forces on Ukraine's borders. Borrell noted that 140,000 troops massed on the border is not to go to have tea. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said the alliance is weighing a more permanent military presence in Southeast Europe in response to Russia's massive military deployment near Ukraine. We're considering more longer-term adjustments to our posture, our presence in the eastern part of the alliance, Stoltenberg said after talks in Brussels with Polish President Andrzej Duda. If Russia really wants less NATO close to the borders, they get the opposite. Merger would create fifth largest airline. Frontier makes $3 billion bid for Spirit Airlines by Megan Ululani Boynton, The Denver Post. Denver-based Frontier Airlines is making a bid to buy Spirit Airlines in a merger worth $6.6 billion, a deal that would create the nation's fifth largest carrier. It's a great day for Colorado, said Barry Biffle, president and CEO of Frontier, which has been a fixture in the state since the 1950s. Everybody wins. Frontier offered almost $3 billion to purchase Spirit. Together, the discount airlines would operate more than 1,000 daily flights and 283 aircraft, flying to 19 different countries, according to their new website. The site says the companies have 350 new aircraft on order. Monday's announcement means Coloradans will gain more access to exotic places, considering Spirit's established presence in the Caribbean, Central America, and South America for over a decade, Biffle said in a Monday telephone interview. Frontier currently serves 120 destinations, and Spirit hits more than 60 locations. Alternatively, more international travelers will also have the opportunity to visit the Centennial State, Biffle added. The two companies aim to create America's most competitive ultra-low fare airline, they wrote in a joint news release on Monday. A decision hasn't been made yet on which brand the combined airline would identify with, Biffle said. Frontier and Spirit anticipate that the combined airline will create an additional 10,000 jobs by 2026. The merger would also result in America's greenest airline, the company said. They claim that the fleet will be the most modern and fuel-efficient fleet in the U.S. The deal is estimated to close in the second half of this year, if approved by Spirit's shareholders and federal regulators. The Biden administration has taken a tough stance on larger corporate mergers, last year issuing an executive order that highlighted consolidation in the airline industry. That prompted the Transportation Department to consider rules to better benefit customers, such as the clear disclosure of certain fees. The Justice Department has tried to block mergers before. In 2013, American Airlines' merger with U.S. Airways garnered a DOJ challenge, which was later settled. And last year, a partnership between American Airlines and JetBlue Airways drew an antitrust suit. If the deal is approved, Frontier equity holders will own 51.5%, with Spirit equity holders making up 48.5%. It will be run by 12 directors, including the CEO, 7 named by Frontier, and 5 by Spirit. William Franke, chairman of Frontier's board, will serve in the same role in the combined company. Frank is the managing partner of Indigo Partners, a private equity firm that invests in budget airlines. According to the New York Times, Indigo has a controlling interest in Frontier's parent company, Frontier Group Holdings, and held a controlling interest in Spirit from 2006 to 2013. Under Indigo's leadership, Spirit went public in 2011 and Frontier went public last year. The Times also reported that the private equity firm has advised and invested in Tiger Air in Singapore, Volaris in Mexico, and Wizz Air in Europe. Biffle, Frontier's chief executive, was a top Spirit executive from 2005 to 2013. The company's leaders said the proposed merger means more leverage to compete with the big four, U.S. Airlines, American Airlines, Delta Airlines, Southwest Airlines, and United Airlines. We are thrilled to join forces with Frontier to further democratize air travel, said Ted Christie, president and CEO of Spirit, in a statement, adding that the union will shake up the airline industry. The coronavirus pandemic rattled the aviation industry, with consumer demand tanking in 2020 as government orders mandated would-be travelers to stay at home. Passenger traffic in April 2020 was 96% lower than it was 1 year prior, the U.S. Government Accountability Office reports. Airlines are now in recovery mode, with average fares still well below 2019 levels, according to Airlines for America. While new ticket sales are climbing, corporate and long-haul international travel remains curtailed, the trade association reports. COVID-19 outbreaks have also caused flight cancellations as ill crew members led to staffing shortages. The Wall Street Journal's 2021 airline scorecard found that Frontier had the second fewest flight cancellations, falling just behind Delta. However, Spirit almost hit the bottom of the list, ranking 8th out of 9. Both airlines took public relation hits last year in regards to customer service. Colorado Attorney General Phil Weiser singled out Frontier in January for the number of complaints his office had received about the airline. And in August, bad weather combined with staffing shortages caused Spirit to cancel hundreds of flights, including 40% on one day, leaving a lot of travelers scrambling to find new flights home. Still, Frontier and Spirit are actually deploying more capacity for air passenger transportation in the first quarter of this year compared to the first quarter of 2019. A4A details. The two companies, along with Allegiant Air, are growing the fastest in system-wide scheduled available seat miles, an industry measurement that the Bureau of Transportation Statistics defines as equal to one aircraft seat carried 1 mile. The team at the Denver International Airport will be closely monitoring the process to fully analyze the impact of the merger, Public Information Officer Stephanie Figuerosa said Monday. Because the merger requires regulatory approval, the team will await further details in the coming weeks, the spokesperson continued. Out of 115 full-service contact gates at DIA, Frontier occupies 9, while Spirit has 2, Figueroa said. The airport reports that it generates more than $33.5 billion for the region annually. Denver has proven to be one of the most resilient markets in terms of recovery from the pandemic, and this position has been supported by competitive operating costs at the airport, Figueroa added. Stock prices for both airlines rose on the news Monday. Spirit closed the trading day at $25.46, a 17% increase, while Frontier Group Holdings Incorporated closed at $12.82, up about 3.5%. Jeffco Health Director resigns, by Meg Wingerter, The Denver Post. Dr. Don Comstock, who led Jefferson County's public health department through the second year of the COVID-19 pandemic and was a frequent target of those opposed to masking, offered her resignation Monday following a lengthy meeting with the county's health board that was closed to the public. The Jefferson County Board of Health voted unanimously to accept Comstock's resignation. Comstock will be put on paid administrative leave for a time to finalize the details of her resignation, board member Kimberly Krapek said. Dr. Comstock will not be acting as executive director of Jefferson County Public Health during this time, Krapek said. The board also voted to allow its president, Sherry John, to appoint an interim director. Comstock's employment was the only matter on the agenda for Monday's special meeting of the Board of Health. About 200 people tuned into the virtual meeting, which largely consisted of a closed executive session. None of the board members commented publicly about what happened in the two-hour executive session or whether they had asked for Comstock's resignation. No public explanation was offered as to her departure. About 2 hours after the meeting, Jefferson County Public Health released a statement from John thanking Comstock for her public health expertise and guidance during the pandemic. We are grateful to Dr. Comstock's service and look forward to keeping the public updated as we put together a transition team and search for the next director, John said. Comstock was hired in February 2021. She previously had worked as a professor of epidemiology at the Colorado School of Public Health and was a member of the Jefferson County Board of Health from 2017 to 2020. Earlier in the pandemic, she assisted the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment in investigating new COVID-19 cases and contact tracing. The previous director, Dr. Mark Johnson, had planned to retire in early 2020, but extended his stay because of the pandemic. Comstock wasn't popular with some segments of the public, especially after the Board of Health voted to reinstate a mask mandate near the peak of the fall 2021 surge. Jeffco Kids First, a group that backed conservative school board candidates in last year's election, had been actively pushing for Comstock's removal. The majority of the 4-member public health board generally voted in favor of the anti-COVID-19 measures Comstock had publicly asked for, though, and didn't express dissatisfaction in their open meetings. The county's mask mandate is scheduled to end February 18th. Denver, Adams, and Arapahoe counties lifted their mandates for most settings over the weekend, though Denver will continue to require masks in schools, childcare centers, and public transportation. The board also voted last week to repeal a requirement that unvaccinated county employees undergo routine testing. local governments within Jefferson County could still opt to test their employees regularly, though it's probably not going to be common given the cost of purchasing test kits. COVID-19 in Colorado. Cases still high, but no longer unprecedented. New reported cases well below Omicron's January peak. By Med Wingerter, the Denver Post. Colorado's COVID-19 numbers are no longer unprecedented, but they're still high enough that it's wise to keep masks handy for a while, a member of the state's modeling team said Monday. The state reported 21,268 new cases in the week ending Sunday, near the high point of the fall 2021 surge driven by the virus's Delta variant. At the worst point of the current Omicron-fueled wave, in early January, the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment reported more than 90,000 cases in a single week. COVID-19 deaths continued to increase, however, approaching levels seen at the peak of the Delta wave in November. So far, the state has reported 258 deaths from COVID-19 in the third week of January, and that number could increase as late reports come in. The percentage of tests coming back positive also returned to the precedented level, averaging 12% over the last week, the lowest rate since Christmas. That's still higher than the state's goal of 5%, but indicates the public health system has a better picture of how many people are infected than it did in recent weeks. Hospital admissions were at roughly the level seen at the trough between the Delta and Omicron waves, with 979 people hospitalized statewide with confirmed COVID-19. That's still well above previous lows, however. During summer 2021, between 250 and 300 people were hospitalized with COVID-19 any given day. It's unlikely that hospital capacity will be in jeopardy again anytime soon, said Beth Carlton, an associate professor of environmental and occupational health at the Colorado School of Public Health. But getting rid of masks is premature when the virus is this widespread, she said. Things are much better, but we still are at high levels, she said. When Denver, Adams, and Arapahoe counties announced they were lifting their mandates, their public health directors noted Omicron was running out of potential hosts. But running out is not the same as has run out, and many kids remain unvaccinated, Carlton said. I think that at some point it will be appropriate to have this conversation about no longer requiring masks in schools, she said. If you get rid of masks when transmission is high, it will facilitate spread to those remaining susceptible people. So far, it appears unlikely that the latest variant, known as BA2, would cause another surge, Carlton said. BA2 is somewhat more contagious than Omicron, also known as BA1, but it doesn't seem to be any better at infecting people who recently recovered from the virus or who were vaccinated. That means BA2 could be better able to reach the remaining susceptible people than Omicron, but given that the pool of potential hosts is shrinking, the damage it could cause would likely be limited, Carlton said. It could, however, lengthen the time it takes for the current wave to bottom out, she said. If they both have the same immunity profile and one is more infectious, provided it gets here in time, it should outcompete Omicron, she said. Medical advisor criticized before midterms. Fauci under attack from Republicans across U.S. by Cheryl Gay Stolberg, The New York Times Company, byline, Columbus, Ohio. When Jane Timken kicked off an 8-week advertising campaign on the Fox News Channel in her bid for the Republican nomination for Senate, she did not focus on immigration, health care, or the economy. Her first ad was titled, Fire Fauci. Its subject, Dr. Anthony Fauci, President Joe Biden's top medical advisor for the coronavirus, is also under attack in Pennsylvania, where Mehmet Oz, a television doctor who has entered the Republican Senate primary there, calls him a petty tyrant. In Nebraska, an ad shows Jim Pillen, a Republican running for governor, dressed in hunting gear and cocking his gun after saying, "And Fauci, don't get me started." Republican attacks on Fauci are not new. Former President Donald Trump, irked that the doctor publicly corrected his falsehoods about the virus, called him a disaster, and repeatedly threatened to fire him. Senator Rand Paul, a Republican of Kentucky, has grilled Fauci in nationally televised hearings, and Fauci, true to his fighter from Brooklyn roots, has punched back. But as the 2022 midterm elections approach, the attacks have spread across the nation, intensifying as Fauci draws outside attention in some of the most important state and local races on the ballot in November. The Republican war on Fauci is partly a sign of Trump's strong grip on the party, but Fauci, both his friends and detractors agree, has also become a symbol of something deeper. The deep schism in the country, mistrust in government, and a brewing populist resentment of the elites, all made worse by the pandemic. And Fauci, whose perpetual television appearances have made him the face of the COVID-19 response, and who is viewed by his critics as a high and mighty know-it-all who enjoys his celebrity, seems an obvious person to blame. Populism is essentially anti-establishment, anti-expertise, anti-intellectual, and anti-media, said Whit Ayers, a Republican strategist, adding that Fauci is an establishment expert intellectual who is in the media. For the 81-year-old immunologist, a venerated figure in the world of science, it is a jarring last chapter of a government career that has spanned half a century. As director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, a post he has held since 1984, he has helped lead the response to various public health crises, including AIDS and Ebola, and advised 8 presidents. He has never revealed a party affiliation. President George H.W. Bush once cited him as a hero. Now, though, some voters are parroting right-wing commentators who compare Fauci to brutal Nazi Dr. Josef Mengele. Candidates in hotly contested Republican primaries like Ohio's are trying to out-Trump one another by supplanting Speaker Nancy Pelosi with Fauci as a political boogeyman. In Pennsylvania, Oz recently ran a Twitter ad calling for a debate, not between candidates, but between him and Fauci. In Wisconsin, Kevin Nicholson, a one-time Democrat running for governor as a conservative outsider, said Fauci should be fired and referred to prosecutors. In Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis released an advertisement last month telling Fauci to pound sand via the beach sandals the governor's reelection campaign is now selling. Freedom over Fauci flip-flops. DeSantis has coined a new term, Fauciism. In Washington, lawmakers are taking aim at Fauci's salary, finances, and influence. "I didn't make myself a polarizing figure," Fauci declared in an interview. "I've been demonized by people who are running away from the truth." The anti-Fauci fever has taken its toll on his personal life. He has received death threats. His family has been harassed, and his home in Washington is guarded by a security detail. His standing with the public has also suffered. In a recent NBC News poll, just 40% of respondents said they trusted Fauci, down from 60% in April 2020. Still, Ayers said, Fauci remains for many Americans one of the most trusted voices regarding the pandemic. In a Gallup poll at the end of 2021, his job approval rating was 52%. On a list of 10 officials, including Biden and congressional leaders, only 2 scored higher, Chief Justice John Roberts and Jerome Powell, the chairman of the Federal Reserve. Republican strategists are split on whether attacking Fauci is a smart strategy. Ayers said it could help rev up a base in a primary, but backfire in a general election, especially in a swing state like Ohio. But John Fehery, another strategist, said many pandemic-weary Americans viewed Fauci as Mr. Lockdown, and it made sense for Republicans to run against both Fauci and lockdowns. Here in Ohio, Timken, a Harvard graduate and former chairwoman of the Ohio Republican Party, who promises to advance the Trump agenda without fear or hesitation, is doing just that. Her ad shows a parent struggling to put a mask on a screaming toddler, which she brands child abuse. The spot, she said in an interview, was prompted by what she hears from voters who are resentful of vaccine mandates, confused by shifting public health advice, and tired of being told what to do. It taps into the real frustration they feel, Timken said, that Fauci claims to be the bastion of science, but I think he's playing God. She is one of three candidates with elite academic credentials who are going after Fauci in a crowded primary for the seat that Senator Rob Portman, a Republican, is giving up. The others are J.D. Vance, a lawyer with a Yale degree and the author of the best-selling memoir, Hillbilly Elegy, and Josh Mandel, a former Ohio State Treasurer, whose law degree is from Case Western Reserve University. Vance called Fauci a ridiculous tyrant during a rally with Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, the far-right Republican banned from Twitter for spreading COVID-19 misinformation. Mandel has railed against Fauci for months on Facebook and Twitter, calling him a liar and one of the biggest frauds in American history. If Democrats lose seats in the midterm elections, as many expect, Fauci may have a Republican-controlled Congress to contend with. Another Republican from Ohio, Representative Jim Jordan, who claims that Fauci knew the coronavirus came from a lab, has vowed that Republicans will investigate him if they win control of the House. Some of Fauci's friends are urging him to avoid that possibility by retiring. He has been working on a memoir, but cannot look for a publisher while he is still a federal employee. Fauci says Republicans will not dictate the terms of his retirement, and he has no plans at the moment to step down. And he said he's not worried about any investigation. I can't think of what they would want to investigate except this whole pile of lies that they're throwing around, he said. Advisor to Biden, White House, top scientist quits over treatment of staff, by Zeke Miller, The Associated Press, Byline, Washington. President Joe Biden's top science advisor, Dr. Eric Lander, resigned Monday, hours after the White House confirmed that an internal investigation found credible evidence that he mistreated his staff. An internal review last year, prompted by a workplace complaint, found evidence that Lander, the director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy, and science advisor to Biden, bullied staffers and treated them disrespectfully. The White House rebuked Lander over his interactions with the staff, but initially signaled Monday that he would be allowed to remain on the job, despite Biden's Inauguration Day assertion that he expected honesty and decency from all who worked for his administration and would fire anyone who shows disrespect to others on the spot. But later Monday evening, Press Secretary Jen Psaki said Biden had accepted Lander's resignation with gratitude for his work at OTSP on the pandemic, the cancer moonshot, climate change, and other key priorities. Lander, in his resignation letter, said, "I am devastated that I caused hurt to past and present colleagues by the way in which I have spoken to them. I believe it is not possible to continue effectively in my role, and the work of this office is far too important to be hindered," he added. The White House said Biden did not request Lander's resignation. It marks the first cabinet-level departure of the Biden administration. Earlier Monday, Psaki said senior administration officials had met with Lander about his actions and management of the office, but indicated he would be allowed to stay on the job, saying the administration was following a process to handle workplace complaints. The White House said Lander and OSTP would be required to take certain corrective actions as part of the review. It also said the review did not find credible evidence of gender-based discrimination and that the reassignment of the staffer who filed the original complaint was deemed appropriate. Lander on Friday issued an apology to staffers in his office, acknowledging, "I have spoken to colleagues within OSTP in a disrespectful or demeaning way." Alleges police shot him in chin with projectile during protests. Volunteer medic is suing Denver, by Noel Phillips, the Denver Post. Another man injured during the 2020 police protests in Denver, this time a public health anthropologist, is suing the city and police officers, alleging they violated his First Amendment right to free speech after he was shot in the chin with a projectile. Gabriel Sloat joins dozens of other people who have sued Denver after being injured by projectiles fired by police officers during the 2020 protests that were sparked by the murder of George Floyd by a Minneapolis police officer. Their injuries have included gaping wounds, lost eyesight, broken bones, and concussions, as well as pain from tear gas and pepper spray that police deployed throughout the summer as thousands of people gathered to demonstrate against police brutality. Denver Police Department spokesman Doug Shepman, said the department does not comment on pending litigation. Schlott went to the protests on May 31, 2020, in downtown Denver to volunteer as a medic because he had experience helping people who were working in West Africa. He joined a line of people near 14th Street and Broadway who were facing off with police officers dressed in riot gear, according to the lawsuit filed Monday in U.S. District Court in Denver. Schlott moved to the front of the crowd to tell people to watch their eyes and protect their faces. And as the police line advanced, he tried to pull people out of the way. Denver police officers shot a woman standing next to Schlott in the chest with a tear gas canister, the lawsuit said. He placed a traffic cone over the canister as he tried to help her. Then he felt what he described as the sensation as getting hit with a baseball bat, the lawsuit said. As Schlott pulled the woman away from police, other protesters told him his chin was falling off, the lawsuit said. The projectile, known as a kinetic impact projectile, or rubber and plastic bullets, had left a hole in his chin. Blood poured down his shirt, and a friend helped put pressure on the wound, the lawsuit said. Schlott was treated at Swedish Medical Center, and eventually will need cosmetic surgery to restore his chin, according to the lawsuit. He was merely acting as a medic and attempting to help those who were injured by police brutality during the protests. There was absolutely no justification for using any force on Mr. Schlott, let alone blowing off his chin with the KIP, the lawsuit said. Schlott's lawsuit recounts dozens of reports and includes photographs of other people who were injured by police projectiles. It names Denver Police Chief Paul Pazin, Commander Patrick Phelan, two lieutenants, and two officers as defendants. Schlott claims that police from Denver and other agencies who responded to the protests purposefully shot at peaceful demonstrators to discourage them from using their right to free speech and to assemble. They celebrated when protesters were injured, the lawsuit, filed by Andy McNulty of Kilmer, Lane, and Newman, stated. And they did all of this with one goal, to discourage people from exercising their First Amendment rights. The joy that DPD officers felt while retaliating against peaceful protesters reaffirmed the underlying principle of the protests. Last month, Denver agreed to pay $500,000 to a college student after police shot him in the eye with a 40-millimeter sponge round during the 2020 protests. Days later, three more men filed lawsuits alleging police shot them in the eye with less lethal munitions during protests. And in September, 50 people joined two lawsuits to sue the department because they were injured or arrested during the protests. Denver City Council approves $3.9 million more for safe outdoor spaces, tent sites for homeless, by Joe Rubino, the Denver Post. Denver City Council members showed their faith in safe outdoor spaces on Monday, committing another $3.9 million toward the program that offers people living homeless on the streets temporary shelter in ice fishing tents on fenced-in sites with portable toilets, power, and Wi-Fi. It's immediate and it reduces street homelessness, Councilwoman Robin Nitsch said prior to joining the yes votes in an 11-1 approval of the contract. Nitsch asked people who are not sure how to feel about the sanctioned campsites if they prefer seeing people sleeping in parks, on sidewalks, or in alleys, or if they think those people would be better served in an organized, supervised environment where they have access to services that could help them move toward permanent housing. The lone no vote Monday came from Councilwoman Amanda Sawyer, who is opposed spending any public money on the temporary outdoor sites. She said the city's housing department intentionally passed on spending $500,000 on a hotel in her district that could have housed people experiencing homelessness. We all want to help people, Sawyer said. We just have different opinions on how we should be prioritizing our spending. The Colorado Village Collaborative has been operating safe outdoor spaces in various places in the city since December 2020. City leaders first embraced the idea in the spring of 2020 as the COVID-19 pandemic made group shelters less safe because of the possibility of the virus spreading. In 2021, relying on private support and roughly $900,000 from the city, the collaborative was able to host 242 people in SOS tent sites for various lengths of time. 47 of those people transitioned to more stable housing, according to the nonprofit. With the more than fourfold funding increase Monday's contract granted the nonprofit, it expects to operate four sites in 2022 and accommodate 370 people that might otherwise be sleeping in tents on sidewalks or in cars. The nonprofit's goal is to get 90 residents out of its tents and into more stable housing over the course of the contract. The $3.9 million is coming from federal American Rescue Plan Act funding and will support the program through the end of the year. The site's opponents say that the Colorado Village Collaborative doesn't do enough to enforce its rules against drugs and alcohol at the sites. Some have urged the city to do more surprise inspections, including bringing in drug-sniffing dogs. Craig Arfston, a member of the Citizens for a Safe and Clear Denver, spoke against the contract Monday, saying more guardrails need to be put in place to protect surrounding neighborhoods, especially around drug use. We want to have a mutually agreeable good neighbor agreement, Arfston said. Kucha Montoya, who runs the Safe Outdoor Spaces program for the collaborative, said that the nonprofit has good neighbor agreements in place for five of the six sites it has operated over the last 14 months. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.